This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What could force the great ocean current known as the Gulf Stream to stop warming the UK, Scandinavia, and Northern Europe? In our 2021 show, Johannes Lohmann explained the rate of ice melt could drive further weakening of the ocean current. Technically, it is called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC. If that weakens or collapses, the largest single disaster in human history unfolds, a mini ice age for the North Atlantic countries in the middle of a hotter planet. At least, maybe that's what will happen. We need to know when and why. New science finds another key factor. It is not just the amount of carbon we emit, but how fast we do it, and that affects the AMOC system. Dr. Camille Hankel published the new paper in December 2024 in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Camille is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Washington. She specializes in atmosphere and geospace sciences. Her previous four papers, as lead author, are about the Arctic sea ice stability and abrupt winter Arctic sea ice loss. Camille Hankel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I'm excited to be here.
We heard how glacier melt can speed up collapse of this key ocean current in the North Atlantic, but this is the first time I've encountered a direct connection between carbon dioxide emissions and a weakening of the AMOC. Can you introduce us to that connection?
Yeah, so I think traditionally people looked at the influence of ice melts on the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation because of the fresh water signal that those ice melts induce. But in the past maybe 10 years, there has been a little bit more of a focus on looking at CO2-induced changes to the AMOC in general, which would encompass the ice melt that is caused by warming from CO2, but also direct temperature effects on the ocean depth and upper ocean due to CO2 changes. It has been around for a little while, this sort of looking at CO2-induced changes on the AMOC, and I can explain a little bit why we expect changes from CO2, not just through this mechanism of glacier ice melt, as you've mentioned. The idea there is that this circulation is at least in part driven by ocean density, so both the difference between the South Atlantic and North Atlantic ocean densities and the difference between the upper ocean density and the deep ocean. And a key part of the circulation is this deep convection in the North Atlantic. So this is the fact that the North Atlantic surface waters are quite heavy, so they actually induce this strong sinking motion, which causes those waters to sink down to the bottom and then have a return flow along the deep ocean moving southward, where eventually those waters upwell in different parts of the ocean and recirculate back north. So if you're concerned about density, there's two things that can affect ocean density. That's the salinity of the ocean and the temperature of the ocean. So while a lot of the previous work that looked at glacier ice melt is concerned with this salinity route towards disrupting the ocean density, which is the freshening of the upper ocean due to glacier ice melt, you can also have density effects on the ocean from temperature effects. So heating of the upper ocean will also make those upper ocean waters less dense, which could potentially inhibit this sinking motion and disrupt this large-scale circulation.
So what brought you to examine the rate of change for carbon dioxide emissions rather than the total CO2 in the atmosphere or the amount of warming?
Yeah, I mean, the total amount of CO2 and associated warming is clearly the main driver of global future climate changes and its impacts. And a lot of time has been spent, rightly so, on that topic. However, I felt that we could kind of anticipate both from intuition and from some established theory that the rate of warming should also impact the climate system in general, in particular the slower parts of the climate system, like the ocean. But just a lot less attention has been paid to this future emission scenarios. When I was kind of preparing for this project, I found that, interestingly, there were a couple of studies back in the 90s that explicitly looked at the impact of the rate of CO2 change on the climate system, but they were mostly using either idealized, simplified, or just less sophisticated climate models than what we have today. And then it seemed like there was a lull and not a lot of interest in the topic of the rate of CO2 change and its impacts until maybe in the last 5 years, where this has started to pick up again, but mostly from a perspective of simple mathematical models and kind of the interesting dynamics that you can get in those mathematical models, or from using fairly idealized climate models. So I thought this topic really kind of needed an update, and especially with all of the focus on the AMOC in recent years, I aim to try to isolate the impact of the rate of CO2 change in a modern, fully coupled global climate model. That means it has sea ice, land, ocean, atmosphere dynamics all in play. And of course, the main exciting thing that I found is, and then spent a lot of time trying to understand, was that the AMOC weakens more when the rate of CO2 changes faster, even when you change the amount of CO2 the same. So this really suggests that, again, while the amount of warming or the amount of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere is really important, the rate of change is itself potentially a driver of some of the key features of the large-scale climate.
And your paper suggests a scenario where a slowing AMOC gets weaker through a kind of feedback effect involving expanding sea ice. Actually, the chain of events you describe is more complex than that, but let's talk about the sea ice. Most science and your previous four papers forecast pretty well the opposite, continued sea ice loss as warming arrives. So why would you suggest sea ice could increase?
Yeah, it's a little bit unintuitive, but it's important that we kind of clarify the time frame and the specific greenhouse gas or warming scenario we're talking about when we discuss sea ice loss or sea ice regrowth. So Arctic sea ice has been disappearing in recent decades and will continue to do so if we keep increasing greenhouse gas concentrations. There's no doubt about that. But what I found in this specific scenario where you eventually stop increasing CO2 at a certain point, but the AMOC continues to weaken after you stopped increasing CO2, is that in that scenario, the Arctic sea ice undergoes this temporary period of modest regrowth before eventually melting again. So in this scenario, you do have initial ice melt as you increase CO2, but then you stop increasing CO2. The AMOC, which normally brings a lot of heat into the Arctic, continues to weaken and slow down, so you don't get as much of this heat transport into the Arctic. And that actually leads to enough net cooling in the Arctic, again, after you stopped increasing CO2, to induce some sea ice growth, even though your globe as a whole is a lot warmer at this point due to elevated CO2 levels. And then something I was pretty excited to find, that, as you alluded to in the question, this period of sea ice regrowth actually causes additional AMOC weakening, which forms a positive feedback cycle. So you're amplifying the AMOC changes through this, what I call an AMOC ocean heat transport sea ice feedback.
And you talk about a tipping point in Arctic sea ice loss. Why do you think there is one?
Yeah, you're referring to some of my earlier papers there. I guess I would actually be pretty hesitant to conclusively commit to the idea that there is definitely a tipping point in Arctic sea ice loss. I should clarify maybe that I'm using the term tipping point in its more strict mathematical definition, which is some element of the climate system that has multiple equilibrium states for the same CO2 concentration, and where an abrupt change is caused when you cross a threshold where one of those equilibrium states disappears, and that forces a really rapid transition to the other equilibrium state. So that would be, in the case of sea ice, a rapid transition from an ice-covered to an ice-free state. And this definition is more narrow than just any kind of abrupt change in sea ice. Back to your questions, it's pretty well established that although summer sea ice is currently melting quite rapidly, it's not governed by this type of tipping point that I just described. On the other hand, the answer for a tipping point in winter Arctic sea ice is a bit more complicated. So winter sea ice is that seasonal ice that will still regrow each winter and then melt away in the summer after the year-round ice is gone. And I spent a lot of my PhD working on this question of winter Arctic sea ice tipping points from different angles. And I found that some, but not all, global climate models show behavior that looks sort of qualitatively like a tipping point. So there is a period of really abrupt winter Arctic sea ice disappearance, which could be governed by a tipping point. And I also found a plausible positive feedback mechanism that could explain this tipping point. But I also found that it's really hard to actually conclusively say whether abrupt change in a global climate model is caused by a true tipping point, due to various modeling and computational challenges. So you can imagine if identifying a tipping point in a model is already pretty hard, showing that tipping point exists in the Earth's climate, as in the real world, not in model land, seems even harder to me, even when this tipping point, if it exists, wouldn't occur for another 100 to 200 years. So all that to say, I think winter Arctic sea ice loss, although it's farther down the road, is probably likely to be more abrupt than summer sea ice loss, but whether this abruptness is caused by a tipping point is still an open question.
Yeah, most of our guests talk about an ice-free Arctic in the summertime, probably at a peak in September and then back to freezing in the winter. And that summer opening could come as early as in the next 10 years, some people have suggested. We don't know. We don't hear much about a year-round open Arctic Ocean with very little winter sea ice. Could you talk to us more about that and how possible that is?
Yeah, I think we don't hear about it as much because whether or not we actually get there at all to a year-round ice-free Arctic depends not just on the global greenhouse gas emissions in the next 10 or 20 years, but up to several decades to centuries from now. And at that point, you just get to be very uncertain about what sort of emission scenario we're going to follow. You also have this issue that, I mean, maybe it's not an issue, but the fact that a lot of climate models and emission scenarios are only run out until the year 2100, that sort of historically has been one of the benchmark years that you stop running the models at, just because of the time horizon that governments and people care about. And the models don't simulate year-round ice-free conditions or the loss of winter Arctic sea ice by that time. So I don't think you'll really see anyone claiming to accurately predict when or even if we'll have a year-round ice-free Arctic because it's so far out. But in the handful of climate models that I've looked at that are run past 2100 and under the sort of highest emission scenarios, this ice-free Arctic occurs sometime between, let's say, 2150 and 2250. So like I said, sort of more than 100 years from now.
And getting rid of ice in the Arctic sounds good for people living further south. It'd be great for global shipping, and some countries hope to get gas, oil, or valuable minerals from the Arctic land or from the seabed. It might even open up settlement. Do you think a loss of winter sea ice might have bigger downsides?
Yeah, I guess the whole notion of upsides and downsides is maybe more of a value judgment and therefore depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to a polar bear, the upsides of increased shipping opportunities aren't particularly exciting, and the loss of your main hunting habitat is a pretty big deal. A lot of other mammals also use the sea ice for hunting, mating, or migration, and would be affected both by the ongoing loss of summer sea ice that we're seeing right now and the sort of more distant in the future winter Arctic sea ice loss. Similarly, the timing of seasonal algal and phytoplankton blooms, which are affected by the penetration of sunlight through the ice or in open ocean conditions, would be likely disrupted. I assume this will have impacts kind of moving up the marine food chain as the phytoplankton really forms the base of marine life. But I don't know if people have really looked at the details of that when you start talking about a century from now. So there's all these sort of local ecosystem effects that also potentially be disruptive to some of the indigenous communities that live in the high Arctic and are obviously affected by it. Many different environmental changes. Outside of the local effects, we suspect there's a lot of maybe more remote climate and weather impacts of sea ice loss, which could affect the mid-latitudes, in other words, North America and Eurasia. Arctic sea ice loss is one of the main drivers of Arctic amplification, something you've probably come across, which is this phenomenon where the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the globe, probably at least two times faster, if not more. And what that means is when you have the Arctic warming faster than the lower latitudes, this weakens the temperature difference in the north-south direction, which can really alter large-scale atmospheric dynamics in a variety of complicated ways and can impact the propagation of weather systems across the mid-latitudes. So you really expect a lot of disruptions to and atmospheric adjustments downstream that are all pretty complex and more than I could name here and always being studied more and more by scientists.
And getting back to that warming current, the AMOC, if it collapses, what would be your vision of a new world after that happens?
Yeah, you started the introduction with some pretty catastrophic images of an ice age over Europe. I tend to be a little bit more conservative, I guess, in my vision of what the world will look like. I think one thing that's important to understand is that whatever the impacts are of an AMOC weakening or collapse, it's crucial to note that these impacts will happen simultaneously with other large-scale impacts from increased greenhouse gas concentration. So those AMOC impacts might either add to or compensate for other greenhouse gas-induced changes. So there was a great paper recently by Katinka Belomo and Oliver Melling in 2024 that actually isolated the impacts of an AMOC weakening simultaneously with CO2 increases. And in this case, they were looking at about a weakening of 50% of the AMOC strength, so not a total collapse. But they found that the AMOC decline in that CO2 warming scenario caused 1 or 2 degrees of cooling over the North Atlantic and Northern Europe. But importantly, that 1 or 2 degrees of cooling is on top of the huge warming signal from, in their case, quadrupling CO2 concentrations. So what it really means is that instead of 7 or 8 or 9 degrees of warming over Northern Europe, you would have 1 or 2 degrees less warming. Similarly, they found some modest impacts of the AMOC collapse on the precipitation changes over Southern Europe and Sub-Saharan Africa. So what I'm describing is obviously kind of a bit in contrast to some previous papers that you've maybe seen that find something like 10 degrees of cooling over Northern Europe due to collapse of AMOC. But a lot of that previous work looked at the impacts of an AMOC collapse in a pre-industrial climate, which means that they took models and then induced an AMOC collapse in a pre-industrial climate, so without CO2 warming. And they do this by adding a ton of fresh water into the North Atlantic to collapse the AMOC. And then they found these sort of huge temperature impacts in the North Atlantic due to the AMOC collapse. But this newer work that I'm referring to shows that when you use those impacts from a pre-industrial climate to try to understand AMOC impacts in a warming climate, you'll actually overestimate the impacts of an AMOC collapse. Of course, I don't want to, you know, undersell how important changes in the AMOC are for the climate system. But in some ways, this could be slightly good news that you're not going to see, in my opinion, some sort of catastrophic ice age over Northern Europe, but that the AMOC is still one of many concerning disruptions to the global climate that we should continue to study.
I get your point of view, and that's helpful to know. It seems to me from the slight reading that I've done, did I get this right, that AMOC can rebound to near pre-industrial strength even after CO2 is much higher than before? And how does that work and how long might that rebound take?
Yeah, that's right. Many studies, and I would even say the majority of climate models, including the one I use in my study, show that the AMOC eventually recovers to its pre-industrial strength after CO2 stops increasing, as you said. And that occurs after you double CO2, as I did in my study, usually after you quadruple CO2 even. And I've seen a few studies that even looked at an 8 times CO2 scenario where you seem to start getting some recovery of the AMOC, though it might not be fully to pre-industrial strength. So this is a process that would take several hundred to even 1,000 years after CO2 stops increasing. So it is a pretty slow process to achieve a full recovery. And a few different mechanisms have been proposed to explain this recovery process. Maybe I'll just give one as an example. So as I mentioned at the beginning, part of the engine that drives the AMOC in the first place is the upper ocean densities. And you need these dense waters in the North Atlantic that cause this deep convection, meaning they sink down and then help drive the whole circulation. When the AMOC slows down, there tends to be a buildup of salt in the South Atlantic. This is because, in general, there's net evaporation in the South Atlantic, which leaves behind saltier waters. And without a strong circulation, these saltier waters don't get advected or mixed away. So when you have this AMOC slowdown, you get this big salinity buildup in the South Atlantic. But if the AMOC doesn't shut down entirely, slowly the salinity anomaly will eventually get advected north. And when it does, it gets to the North Atlantic, and since salty waters are heavier, you now have these heavy waters that are dense and can sink, and you'll sort of reestablish this important convection and start to reinvigorate the whole circulation. So you can kind of think of this process as a negative feedback. So I've been talking a lot about positive feedbacks that amplify changes due to perturbations from anthropogenic forcing or whatever. But there are also negative feedbacks in the climate system that stabilize the climate against perturbations. The key here is that this particular negative feedback operates very slowly over hundreds or thousands of years. So you can get this large change in the AMOC, like a 50% reduction in its strength or even more, that can persist for a couple hundred years. But then slowly, as this negative feedback I just described kicks in, you will eventually get this recovery. And that's how you can kind of get these really different, what I would call transient, even though it's multiple hundreds of years, transient versus equilibrium behavior of the system. So one particular change when you look at a 100, 200, 300-year horizon, and then a really different response if you look at a 1,000-year horizon.
And your first paper, I believe, was on computation, and maybe this background helped you identify shortcuts to model out the Arctic ice. The big global models like CMIP, they take a very long time to run all the scenarios you'd like to, and that costs a lot of money. Could you talk to us about the problem of time and cost to test climate science? I mean, Microsoft's talking about spending $100 billion for servers that will generate AI pictures for users, but we don't seem to have a readily accessible big climate model for the scientists that really need it. Can we fix that?
Yeah, this is a huge challenge in our field, but it is starting to see some movement. But yeah, these CMIP models, which are kind of our state-of-the-art, they're millions of lines of code. They run on many processors, and it's all parallelized to be sort of as efficient as possible, and still it takes a while to run. So in my work, just to give you an example, I'm running a fairly coarse resolution of the model because of these computational limits. So this is kind of the fastest I can get the model to run. And I can simulate about 100 years of simulated climate in one day of waiting for the model to run. So in my work, you know, I was doing many simulations that were multiple thousands of years long. So you are waiting on these changes. And of course, again, I was forced to use this sort of coarser resolution model to even be able to do that, and I would like to go to higher and higher resolution. So it's a tough problem. I mean, machine learning is sort of entering the picture in our field and potentially contributing to ways that you can speed up the model runtime. There's a variety of ways people are using machine learning. Sometimes it's to learn better parameterizations for the model. Sometimes it's to emulate the behavior of a model. So you actually kind of will train a machine learning algorithm to emulate what the sort of full climate model is doing that's based on all of these physics, and then those can run a lot faster. Those are still, I would say, early-ish development, so it's hard to say when those models will start working. And then the main challenge is that if those emulators are sort of based on information from all of the climate data we've seen to date, and those machine learning algorithms in some cases don't necessarily encode physics that we know, will they be translatable to a very different climate in the future when you're getting climate that the machine learning algorithm hasn't seen in its training phase? So it's a little complicated and a little bit outside of my area, but I'm excited to see what tools, new tools are available, especially being pretty early in my career. I imagine I'll see things really change in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
I bet you will. What are you working on next?
Thanks for asking. I'm working on two projects that are sort of interconnected to this AMOC article I just published. One is to sort of really try to prove that the feedback mechanism that I propose in this paper is really the culprit for what I call the rate dependence of the AMOC. So when you have these complicated and vast climate models, it's hard to actually diagnose cause and effect in them. And so often what we'll do is run mechanism denial experiments. So that's where you actually go in and interfere with the model in some way. So in this case, I proposed this positive feedback cycle as an explanation for the AMOC's enhanced weakening under rapid rates of CO2 change. And now I'm working on a project where I disable that feedback mechanism in the model and then see how that affects the AMOC's dependence on the rate of CO2 change. So it's kind of a hypothesis testing that's a direct follow-up from this project. Another thing I'm looking into with a collaborator here at UW is the effect that this AMOC's rate sensitivity has on the Arctic and Arctic amplification in particular. So as I mentioned, people are really concerned about Arctic amplification, and there's a lot of work on the drivers of it. But one thing that's interesting is that in this work, when you get this period of sea ice regrowth that happens after you've stopped increasing CO2 and see the AMOC continue to collapse, you actually see an erasure of the signal of Arctic amplification, meaning for a couple hundred years, the Arctic is warming at the same, well, has warmed the same amount as the rest of the globe because of this kind of reversal of sea ice behavior. So that's pretty cool and something that I don't think people have pointed out before, and we're trying to kind of understand whether this can fully be attributed to the AMOC changes or if there's other stuff going on, but it's kind of a different perspective on Arctic amplification than what we talk about when we talk about the next couple decades.
I hope to spot your next papers when they come out. From the University of Washington, we've been speaking with scientist Camille Hankel. Her new paper is The Effect of CO2 Ramping Rate on the Transient Weakening of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. It was published in PNAS December 23rd. You can find notes and links to follow up in my show blog posted Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Camille, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Radio EcoShock.